Namotasa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhasa. Namotasa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhasa. Namotasa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhasa. Buddhang dhammang sangkhang namassami. Socratic method, is that it, where you ask questions? These kind of questions that I put during the meditation are not suggestions of things that I think are important to look at. And how we pay attention, and why we pay attention to things we do pay attention to, and how we prioritize things seems to me very important. So when you're meditating, the thing about meditation, it highlights the habits of the mind. So it's like a little laboratory, isn't it? Whatever habits and tendencies you have, skills and lack of skill, becomes quite apparent because there's nothing else to really do. So it's very useful place to understand, not just to attain, not just to kind of tranquilize the mind, but to really understand how it works, how mind works. So that kind of question, priority, well, where does your attention go? And why does it go there? So some people were falling asleep. So your attention goes to porridgey kind of thoughts because biology, probably haven't slept enough, you're tired, you had a meal. So the priority there is driven by biology, driven by something which is not quite in your control, not quite, you don't quite understand it. So dullness and sleepiness is a very common thing. For some, maybe thinking about something that happened in the past, set of mind, dwelling on memory. For some, maybe trying to attain to something, some experience that you've had before, some refined state of mind, or tranquility, trying to reach for something. Maybe you've read about something about. So there's all manner of way we pay attention, but there is the kind of necessary part of our life where we have to pay attention to the environment and so on. So if you're driving a car, a Scotch line, and you see a kid on the side of the road, you become very cautious because you're afraid the kid might jump out. If you see a car come really close to your tail and coming on you really, really fast, you become very, very alert. So you pay attention to the objective world, right? That's very natural, and we need to do that a lot. We pay attention to pleasure and pain. So something really attractive, you're drawn to it, you look at it. Maybe you want to own it, something repulsive, you're attracted to it too, but in a negative way. So there's that way of paying attention. And those are the priorities either of necessity or desire or fear. And we have to pay attention to the ice. If it's icy, you know, it was almost, my bird bath got frozen last night, so the birds were skating there, paying attention. So there's that way of paying attention. And sometimes it's cultural, you know, just like what your culture says you should be doing. That's a long, you know, like my priority is to get a job. And I was telling Thomas, you've all heard this story, when I was 10 years old, apparently I said to my parents, I'm not going to work 9 to 5. I didn't remember this. Then I became a monk, my parents were very upset. And then 5 years later, my dad kind of figured out I had a good thing going, and he said, he's done it. No 9 to 5. So that's a priority culturally, you know, like what our parents tell us, what our society tell us, and some of those things are skillful and some are very unskillful. So consumerism tells you need to get these different things to be truly happy and so on. So the question you need to ask yourself is, what's your priority in the spiritual life? Where, you know, what is important for you? So for the most part, our attention is taken by things, objects, experiences. So that's all very well and good, but is there any refuge, is there any home which is not in the realm of things, not in the realm of emotions, not in the realm of thought, not in the realm of objects? Is there any place or that you prioritize, or is it always around objects? Is your attention always need to be on objects? Sometimes it needs to be, sure, but is it always there? Like when you walk around the gardens or whatever, where does your attention go? So the suggestion in the spiritual life is there's something very much missing in our lives if we don't learn to pay attention to attention itself. If we don't learn to actually pay attention to listening rather than the objects of listening. If we don't learn to be aware of awareness rather than just be aware of objects. Because objects are, they're not your real home, are they? They're not your real home. So do you understand that kind of idea? Is there a place of safety, refuge, that is not an object? That is not a thing, it's not an experience, it's not an emotion. Is that real for you? Or is that just a kind of vague spiritual Buddhist idea? What is it that is there before you think? And what is it that is there after a thought? What is it there that's before you had the mood of annoyance? And what is it there when the mood of annoyance ended? You know, what was there before you went to sleep, and what was there when you woke up? What was there when you had the ice cream and apple crumble? What was there before that? And what was there after the sweetness of that? What was that? What is that? Is there anything there? Or is it just a kind of flow of experience, one after another, ice cream, brush your teeth, burp? So just one ricocheting, is that all there is to life? Just experience? Is that the only thing? Is it only a series of sense, perceptions, experiences, memories that just go on and on and on and on endlessly? Or is there a dimension, or is there something? As soon as you say something other, then you start to look for the thing. So I think the suggestion in the spiritual life, what we were talking about Sufism yesterday and Thomas Merton this morning and so on, that all mystical traditions, all truly spiritual traditions, people have noticed something, haven't they? They have noticed that. And it's not simply psychological well-being. It's not simply like a project of self-correction or a project of self-development. More than that, isn't it? To me, it is. And when you just listen to the fan, and then when you feel your hands, I do this a million times, it's very pragmatic, and when you feel the warmth of your hands, between the two, between the change, you notice the unchanging. If you're really attentive. And if you can't do that and you have to think, well then you'll never notice the unchanging because you'll be in the changing. And when you really perceive and notice something changing, And you no longer become taken by the thing that is changing. That very movement shows you the non-movement. If you're not taken by the thing which is changing, you listen to sound, change the sense object, feel your hands, there's the movement, and there's the non-movement. There's the conditioned, there's the unconditioned. So the spiritual life, to me, it seems, is prioritizing the unconditioned rather than the conditioned, and yet being sensible and turning on the fan, being sensible and washing the dishes, being sensible and taking care of your psoriasis, or whatever mundane things we have to endure in this life. But is life just about one's psoriasis and ice cream? Is that the only thing? Is it just a compulsion from one issue and experience to another, like an endless travelogue to nowhere? Or is there something that's always there? And what is it that's there when you're in Thailand, or when you're in Ottawa, or when you're here? What is it that's there that's not a matter of geography? What is it there that's not a matter of time? You know, out of time. It was, you know, what was there this morning, what was there tonight? It's this kind of way of looking and pondering and prioritizing. So that's the idea of being aware of awareness. So I listen to the fan, and there's the quality of the sound, and then there's the listening itself. What is listening? Listening or awareness is so close to you that you cannot find it. You can only, as Ajahn Sumedho said, you can only be it. It's so close that any, just a millimeter out into an object, you lose it. It's this incredibly subtle stillness of not going out, not going out into any experience. Not through the rejection of experience, because you still need to wash the dishes and drive the car carefully. Not through a rejection of experience, not even saying that experience is better or worse, but just through this curiosity that there is, you know, is there something we're missing? Is there something we're missing in our endless psychologizing of ourselves, or our endless consumption of experience? We have difficulty stopping, don't we? It's like resting, stopping, listening. It's something that's very difficult, and probably always has been. But just that ability to rest the mind rather than always engage it with things, with thought, with talk. You notice that in nature. You know, nature, you go out to the field and you see the green trees, and your mind maybe stops. And then for me, if I make that a priority, then when my mind starts to categorize the trees, I say there's an ash tree, and there's a maple, oh, there's those dead elms. So that's the analyzing mind, which is necessary, but if I only make that the priority, I kind of miss something. I miss something very, very important, that the trees point back to awareness. And that the trees cannot exist without awareness, that the condition cannot exist without the unconditioned. So the point of the conditioned realm in Buddhism is to make it the vehicle rather than the goal. The point of morality is it's the vehicle rather than the goal. But it is necessary to have a vehicle. The point of the meditation is to have a vehicle rather than the goal. The point of generosity is that it's a method rather than an end. The point of compassion that it's part of the methodology rather than the goal. And what happens when the heart relates, or when consciousness, or when awareness, or when you relate to the world from compassion, generosity, attentiveness, brightness, presence, all of those, and you give those priority, what happens is it shines a kind of light on awareness itself, doesn't it? The compassion. One of the things that's very helpful to do is to You think about it. When you get enlightened, when you get enlightened, right? How are you going to feel? You feel pretty damn good, right? You're like, wow, this is it. Now, why not do it now? You know, why wait until 20,000 lifetimes? Unless you've killed a mosquito, then it's 30,000 lifetimes. You know? So you can think in that ridiculous way. But what is the emotion of not having to do anything? What is the emotional valence of I'm home? What does that feel like? What does that feel like? And why not make that the attitude? Or you can make desire the attitude, that I'm, you know, some pathetic Buddhist who's just mumbling along here. I don't really know anything. You know, that kind of very humble, self-disparaging part. But that's not very joyous. So, you know, if I was just reading from the Samyutta, the Buddha says, the texts say, I would not see the final goal as realized just through sorrow and grief. I would see it realized through joy and happiness, something like that. So we emphasize suffering, yeah. But, you know, when you come home, think about it, when you get home, you get back to your kuti or your room and you don't have to listen to anyone. You never listen to me. You know, you just lay down, you're listening, you have a really long day. Like if you're doing a retreat, you're going to retreat for 10 days, and you're doing like 10 hours sitting, and then you lay down, it's just bliss, isn't it? It's, oh. Now what is that? What is that bliss? You think it's the laying down? Yeah, it's physical pleasure, so it's sensual and that. But it's also, there's no desire there. You don't want anything anymore. Oh. It doesn't last long, probably 10 minutes, 5 minutes, if you're kind of thinking about something else. But that's a desirelessness. It's, you know, you don't want anything, you don't need anything. So when you notice the end of a thought, when you awaken to what's going on in your life, that's home. And the realization of home is a very happy, exalted, uplifting, great, I'm back, rather than, oh gosh, I think too much, or I have to try harder, or which is all ego trying to become something else. But the non-becoming, the non-resistance, the non-anticipation in this present moment of awareness, what is that? It's always, home could always only be here now, couldn't it? Couldn't be tomorrow. Couldn't even be here now. So I suggest, like, learn how to feel your heart. Really learn, like, develop this chakra. Learn to live in, not just in thought all the time, in analysis and judgment and all that kind of stuff. You know, like, learn how to physically just find a place, like, where is the place when you feel at ease? Where is it in your body? Now, don't try to manufacture it, like we were saying yesterday. Oh, he says I should go to the heart and just try to pump it out, like some kind of a practice. But when you know, like I have the hummingbird now coming every morning for a bath. So I'm watering the trees, and I get a flow going, and there's the male hummingbird. The female hasn't come yet. And he comes, and he's right there. He's like a foot away from me, right in the water, flapping away. Yeah. And I had Kama do the watering, and he came to him too, so it's not just me. So this little fella brings me a lot of joy. He's got a lot of joy there. Like this is kind of feeling of mudita that we have with nature and things. So that's really important, isn't it? It's really important. And why is it so joyous? It's because I'm not in the way. You know, I'm not trying to figure this out or analyze it. It's just a pure experience of presence. Now the greed mind then wants to adopt 50 hummingbirds and get a whole flock going, right? Some mad thing like that. Or get a photo of it, right? Or get a video, right? And so, but that moment where there is no embellishment of it, there's just the suchness of this experience, and that And what has that bird done? That little bird has brought me back to the unconditioned. Because now there's presence, there's non-desire, there's non-becoming, there's non-resistance. There's this sort of transparency. The self is no longer making a problem of it. Of course, then the next day I go and he's not there, I feel disappointed. But that's not the point, is it? It's not. So we very much get very quickly attached to experience. Right? We feel the joy, and then we think it was the experience that was important. But it wasn't the experience. It was desirelessness. That's what's important, is desirelessness. That's what's important. So we mistake desirelessness for the experience, and there's that. If I can remember that story, that the first monk that I met, Venerable Bhutesiko, he's a great influence on me. He's died since, but you know the myth of Sisyphus? He was the guy that, what did he do? He wasn't the fire one, was he? He offended the gods, so he had to carry a rock up a hill, and right when he got to the top, the rock would, and this is for eternity, the rock would roll down the hill. Now, what did he do with the gods? Anyway, you don't mess with Zeus and those types.
Did he get
fire to
human?
No, wasn't that? That was Prometheus, yeah. Anyway, so we got Sisyphus, who did something naughty and gets eternally damned. And so Sisyphus he's got his rock and he's going up the hill and it's hot and he's sweating and sweating. Almost gets to the top, the rock falls off his shoulder. He runs down, gets down to the hill. There's his rock again, he picks the rock up. Struggle, almost gets to the top. Bang, falls off, goes down the hill. Da, 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 da. So one day he's taking this rock and he's climbing up the hill and he's struggling with the rock and falls down again. Oh, well, okay. And as he's coming down the hill, he sees this old man. And the old man looks at him and says, Sisyphus, I'm old. You know, going down this hill is really good. Could you carry me? He says, what do you mean? This is the best part of the trip. I'm going down, man. I don't have to carry this rock. Sisyphus, I'm an old man. You're strong. Look, you're strong. Just carry me down to the bottom now. He says, in our land, we have the law of karma. You know, in our land, we say that a good deed begets goodness. You know, there's profit for you here. He says, all right, old man. So he lifts the old man up on his shoulders, takes him down, dun, 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 gets down to the bottom of the hill. The old man jumps off and walks off without even saying thank you. He just walks off. So there's his rock, my rock. Sisyphus puts the rock on his shoulders and he's climbing up again, feeling disgruntled, going up, going up, going up. He's sweating, he's holding on to this, and he makes it. He puts the rock down and he makes it to the top of the hill. He's done it. He's beaten the gods. And for the first time in his existence, he sees the beautiful view, because he's not consumed by the rock anymore. This beautiful view, this incredible panorama, and openness and space and green and clouds and blue, and he's just blissed out. But he's also very tired. So he decides he'll have a rest. He sleeps. There's a long rest. And he wakes up and looks around. It's really beautiful here. I think I'll build a house. And I'll start with this rock. So he puts his rock down and he goes down the hill to start to get more rocks. Oh. Do you get it? And that's what we do. You know, we notice the space, we get a sense of the space, the silence of non-desire, and then we say, yeah, how can I own that space? How can I get it as an object? But it's not an object. It's who you are, really, isn't it? And so we pick up our rock. And it goes on and on and on. So when you're, you know, just thinking of priorities, how do you do that? Like, to me it seems that prioritizing something is a matter of intelligence and understanding. Any goal I have, or any sense of a goal, or any aspiration I have, it has to be imbued with some kind of information. And where does that information come from? Well, it comes from my readings, speaking with people, my own observation of life. And so we have priorities. So we have worldly priorities, and then we have this kind of transcendent priority in Buddhism. And to see that it's the worldly priorities are simply a vehicle for remembering this, the unconditioned, is a different way of looking. Because the worldly mind is always prioritizing experience and kind of putting off the religious or the spiritual as something, well, that's what old people do, or that's what monks do, or whatever. Even monks get obsessed with stuff. And so the priority in Buddhism, like when we ordain as bhikkhus, our in the ordination chanting, it says that I take the higher ordination, the upasampada, the going forth or whatever, for the realization of nibbana. Not to be good monks or to build monasteries or to do clever teachings or to write books or to make little boxes. That's not the purpose. And yet we have a very worldly discipline. You know, it's really quite tedious, our rules, and quite exacting in the requirements of diet. But it's not actually all that healthy, our diet sometimes. Chocolate and cheese, right? That's a bit weird, isn't it? Weird too. But there we have this very worldly discipline and yet this very high aspiration. And then in fact, like emotionally, the kind of suggestion that one has as much compassion for all beings as a mother has for her child. And you think about that? And the kind of standard of that, that's really, really high. Now, as an ideal, you're kind of attached to the ideal that I should be loving all the time. You're finished, because you're still an object. Because love is an object, hate is an object, ego is an object. So people sometimes mistake the method for the goal. And then their idealism makes them feel really guilty. So they have an ideal of compassion or ideal of kindness, and then they criticize others when they're not kind and things like that. Lovely. And so there's a kind of tendency to miss the whole point of the unconditioned. But you can see how a mind which is generous and kind has no remorse, has joy, has connection, doesn't have alienation. So you can see it's a method. But to always be that way would also be... What would happen if you demanded of yourself or others that they always be a certain way? Is it possible? Impossible. You know, there's different ways that the heart functions. So that becomes an attachment to the method. To dismiss the method, to say, well, it doesn't really matter what you do, you're enlightened already. Well, yeah, okay, go for it. So to see that morality, like people who keep moral precepts in a very uptight way, doesn't work because they're fearful and they're fear-bound. But people who don't keep moral precepts are also, you know, messy too. Minds are messy. So to keep moral boundaries for the sake of being observant of appetites, for the sake of social harmony, for the sake of a foundation for social enlightenment and individual enlightenment, makes sense. It's a method. So the suggestion is, rather than carry the rock around, notice the moments of non-desire. Just like when, like let's say you sit through a talk in a meditation and you're falling asleep and all the rest of it and struggling in meditation, and maybe then the bell rings and finally you're there. And your mind's been all over the place for 45 minutes and finally you're there. Appreciate that. Even if it's a second, you say, oh, wow, Wonderful. Rather than say, oh, my mind's been all over the place, I'm not a good meditator, then you're in the objects again. So even if, you know, when the bell rings or something, like when something interrupts your meditation, a painful knee or someone coughing, let's say, common, isn't it? You're meditating and you start thinking about a program that you've got lined up for tomorrow, and then someone coughs. And then you awaken then, don't you? And you know, and that's the end of thought. That's the end of self. And right there, if you say, great, I'm home again, you open to the unconditioned. Whereas if you then get caught in the habitual judgments and just really, really try, usually you're just looking for another object. You're out into the objects. The mind which goes out into the objects is the cause, and the result of the mind going out into objects is suffering. The mind not going out into objects is the path. The result of the mind not going out into objects is realization of the end of suffering. It's very simple, very hard to do. Very simple. So each moment, like, you know, when you cough, you've got the rock on the top of the hill. You're there. Don't pick anything up. Just be there. Be the knowing. No grasping, no attachment. And then when you have to grab something, when you have to do something, sure. You ask to cook, you ask to use the streamer, you know, you do it. You do that because it's, you know, appropriate to do. All right, I'll leave that for your reflection.